Thank you for checking out Random Musings from the Clinical Trials Guru. It really means a lot to me that you're listening to this podcast. If you listen and you like the content, then make sure you subscribe, make sure you leave a review. Please do that. And also go check me out on some of my other platforms. I have a long-running YouTube channel. I've got a blog, theclinicaltrialsguru.com. If you're interested in becoming a CRA or you're interested in getting a career in this industry, go to thecraacademy.com. If you're a research site owner interested in getting more studies for your site or negotiating better contracts for your site, go to my blog, theclinicaltrialsguru.com, and check it out. I offer consulting services. If you're a pharma, biotech, life sciences company, a CRO, I own a startup CRO, and we're here to help you, whatever it is you want. If you're a CRO, we can white label a lot of services for you. We have CRA coverage across the country at cost. We can do this at scale. If you're a pharma company, we are a full service CRO, and we're very confident in our pricing, and we are extremely competitive at bidding. And if you're also interested in your own digital marketing and leveraging a podcast maybe for yourself, reach out to me, dan@theclinicaltrialsguru.com. Again, thank you very much and enjoy the show.
Hey everybody, welcome back. Thank you very much for watching, listening. Mina, you know this is going to go on the podcast as well, but it's on YouTube also. So, a day in the life of a CRA. People have been asking for this, and I've done some in the past, but now I get to interview Mina. It's September 2017, so it's more up to date. Now we've got a lot of risk-based monitoring elements and remote monitoring. I can even speak on some of the remote monitoring stuff from my little experience as a CRA, but we have someone who does this all the time, full-time. Mina, he's a CRA. When people meet him, they immediately ask him how much he makes because they know that CRAs make so much money. He has to pay the bill for all his friends when they go out to eat, right?
You know, sometimes it comes up, yeah.
That's what I have to do. Like, when my friends figured out that I'm in research, now I'm the one that pays the bills. Sucks, man.
Yeah.
We're not like NBA players. We're normal people.
That's right.
So Mina's here. Mina works for a CRO, which we will not mention who, but figure it out. There's, with all the consolidation, there's only like four big ones left. How's it going, Mina?
It's going well, Dan. Long time viewer of yours, and I'm glad to be able to share my experiences with you and your viewers.
Thank you for reaching out. I know we had a lot of engagement going on LinkedIn over the last couple of months. So I appreciate you willing to come. It was actually your idea to come on. I have to beg people, and you're like, hey, Dan, I'd love to come on. I was, thank you, Mina. I appreciate that.
You give the content all the time, so I just wanted to give back to your channel and just be here and you know, talk about whatever your viewers want to hear.
Thank you very much. Be prepared to be bombarded with questions from people after the interview. The link's underneath. But Mina, give us a little background. So who are you? How did you get involved in clinical research? Like, it seems like everyone kind of gets involved on accident almost. So give us your story.
So I was always a research guy, right? I started in the academic world. I did the academic. I did the bench research all throughout college. I always loved that aspect of it.
One of those guys.
Yeah, that's me. I love the aspect of, you know, going into a lab and developing and, you know, coming up with something novel to improve, you know, anatomy, medicines, etc. And I did that for a couple years and it was great, but it lacked the clinical aspect of it. You know, it lacked like an interaction with a person. So I basically got an internship for free, you know, just volunteered my time. And
repeat that part again, because I tell my students this all the time, or I tell anyone watching, if you want to get experience, intern. So repeat that again, just so they hear it from someone else.
Of course. I basically just volunteered my time at a clinic. It was within a hospital, but you know, it gave me exposure to what clinical research is. Prior to that, I knew what research is, right? I knew what academic research is, and I knew what medicine was. I just didn't know clinical research, right? So it's kind of bridging both worlds. And at that point, I was like, whoa, I kind of like this. So I decided to pursue it more full time. So I just kept applying and looking at opportunities that would kind of grow. And I basically ended up becoming a CTA for a few months, and then that transitioned into a coordinator job. I did that for a couple years, spoke to many monitors, sat through many monitoring visits, and got a feel for what, you know, they do. And I was like, I like this, you know. I'm actually based out of Philadelphia, and I ended up relocating to Maryland to get my first monitoring job, just because it's that hard to break into the field. So I couldn't turn down the opportunity. So I did that for a couple years in Maryland, and then at that point, unfortunately, the magic number in monitoring realm is 2 years. Everyone looks for 2 years of clinical research experience, but of clinical research monitoring, actually, not experience.
That's right.
However, the caveat is, how are you supposed to get the 2 years of clinical research monitoring if no one's willing to give you that opportunity? So you usually have to, you know, the opportunity isn't going to come to you most of the time. You have to go out and find it. And that's, you know, going on those job boards, asking around, making those connections, building that rapport with everyone you know, asking people to review your CVs, your resumes. I've had a couple monitors that came through and as a coordinator, and they gave me tips and they asked to see my resume. Sometimes on and off, these CROs, they take experienced coordinators, and because they need CRAs, they'll take the time to actually train them in-house.
Yes.
And they'll start entry level.
It's so important what you just said, 2 years of monitoring experience, and you have to go get it. So with my example, when I wanted to dabble just this year, early 2017, into monitoring, late last year and early this year is when I actually started doing that. I had to look at my resume and say, okay, this is, I don't have monitoring experience, but here's what I have done. I've done QA for all the sites that I'm involved with. I'm essentially the in-house monitor, and I had to communicate that at the interview. So everyone has something that's transferable, even if it's not direct monitoring experience, and it really is all about how you demonstrate your understanding of what a monitor, what monitoring job entails.
It's all about the application. You know, monitors need to have very specific skill sets, you know. One of those is attention to detail, right? Now, you can get attention to detail in many ways. You can, QA is attention to detail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, reviewing documents, reviewing SOPs, drafting documents, all that can, that it can transfer over, as you said. So if you don't have direct experience, you can still gauge it to your future employer in that way, and you never know, they may take the chance on you.
Mm-hmm.
It comes down to your personality and your interview skills and a bit of luck, honestly.
Luck and supply and demand. I mean, if there is a need, if there's a shortage of CRAs, they're going to be less picky. If there's a surplus of CRAs, they're going to be extremely picky. So I benefited from that being on the West Coast. There's a shortage here, and they're like, well, he's not really who we need or who we want, but he's who we need right now, and there's no one else.
I feel like the industry kind of goes in waves, too. Like, every couple of years, you'll see it spike, and then they'll need a bunch of people, then they'll dip.
Where are we right now?
I think right now we're actually on the rise up here. I've been seeing a lot of companies, a lot of CROs that are saying, hey, we're willing to take entry-level CRC or experienced CRCs and make them entry-level CRAs, people with experience to join to apply. I feel like being a CRA, it's like hotcakes. You're in demand right now.
Yeah.
Everyone's always trying to contact you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of being a CRA, so what is a day in the life of a CRA? Like now, are you, so you're, how long have you been a CRA for?
I've been a CRA for over 2 years and some change now.
Okay, so you reached that magical number now.
Yeah,
now you can name your job.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's 2 years, and basically it's the same. In every company you go to, the CRA usually has the same function. And that function is basically, one, you go on site and, you know, you source verify data, and basically assure adherence to the protocol and make sure that your subjects are safe. In a nutshell, that's what a CRA does.
So break down what, because some people don't know, what is source data verification?
Source data verification is basically where I look at the CRF, which is the case report form, and the EDC, and you know their source documents, wherever they originally wrote that data down. Contrary to popular belief, it's wherever the first time you write that data, that becomes the source. If it's on a glove, that becomes your source. So you basically make sure that that information is aligned with what they're transcribed into the CRF, and then from the CRF to EDC, basically to make sure that all that information's correct, because at the end of the day, that information gets taken back and it gets locked and cleaned up and analyzed by statisticians, who then spit out the magical number for the, you know, the boards to review, the FDA to review at the end. So maintaining that data integrity is huge.
Mm-hmm.
In what we do, and verifying that data is...
Yeah, because sites, I mean, at the end of the day, sites and CROs are paid to extract data. Like, that's the end product. That's the finalized product. And that's the CRA's job, is to make sure that that data is valid following GCP. Data integrity is what they call it, right?
Exactly. So basically my day. So I would break it up into two separate parts. It's either I'm traveling or I'm not. So most of the time it is traveling.
So are you home? You're home based, right?
I'm home based.
So
yeah.
Different. It's confusing. I've explained it before, but they want to hear it from someone else. In-house versus home-based, both use the word house, but two separate things.
Correct. So I would say an in-house CRA is basically your CRA that is based in an office that's not their home, and their job is to support the traveling CRA.
Okay.
Yep, that's the way I would explain it.
It's a good way to explain it.
CRA is, your job is to support the traveling CRA while they're on site and other locations. So because I am conducting a visit, doesn't mean that my other 15 sites don't need any assistance. They don't need any support. So that is where I can bring in my in-house person, whether it's they become the point of contact while, you know, I'm out of the office traveling. They can send documents to them. They can escalate things to them. And then they can, you know, the in-house CRA can bring it to me, et cetera.
Yeah, so how does that work? Because when my structure, I work for a very small CRO, and I go out to the site, but then my lead CRA is actually the in-house CRA. So I report to her. And when I'm not on site, she's doing all the SDV in between my site visits and handling all the issues. I just do work when I'm at site and then write my report. How does it work for a traditional CRO? Do they report to you, the in-house CRAs?
No. So they're usually more of my counterparts. You know, we work together. They do not report to me. Everyone reports into what we call a CTM, or a clinical trial manager. and they're project based. And you know, sometimes you have someone in house to support you. Sometimes you don't. Depending on the size of the CRO, the budget, the allocations, it seems like in your scenario here, your in house CRA is also playing a CRA function, and she's wearing multiple hats.
Yes,
that's good for her. Because if she got in as an in-house CRA, you know, that on-site experience that she gets while you're not there, that's integral for moving into bigger CROs who have more of a traditional route.
Gotcha. So in your case, everyone reports to the CTM, clinical trial manager. Is that the same as a project manager?
No.
That's different. So can you explain those two, like the differences?
Yeah. Yeah, so basically your clinical trial manager is specific and runs the day-to-day operation of your project. The project manager does more of the budgets, the finances, that kind of interaction. So the CTM works with the CRAs, the in-house CRAs, and basically just moves the day-to-day operations. I would look at them as two distinct routes.
Yeah.
Management and then CTM.
Interesting, because I've worked for two small CROs, and now I have my own startup CRO, so three technically, but we're just learning from everyone. In the smaller CROs, at least the ones I've been involved with, there is no CTM, and the project manager does what you mentioned that your project manager does and what the CTM does.
Right. So in the smaller ones, you know, people tend to wear many, many more hats. They can, you know, they'll do budgets, contracts, they'll do bid defenses, they'll do all that stuff. But, you know, another times that's not the case. And then I'm leaving out a third person who's also very important, and that's your line manager or your clinical manager, who's basically runs your growth within the company and looks out for your well-being, because the CTM is very project based.
Yes.
The line manager is more of like the manager that helps in your training and your development and in your growth throughout the company.
Is that your lead CRA?
No, that's they're
separate. Both. Look how many different roles there are. Wow.
There are like three managers that you would basically all report to in one way or another.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's not the lead CRA. The lead CRA could be anyone. Sometimes a lead CRA is just a normal CRA, they're just given a lead title because they're taking additional responsibilities on the trial. That may be.
It's so interesting how the big CROs have everything compartmentalized, and that the smaller CROs, it's like just one person does like three things you mentioned.
Well, of course, and I can speak to that on both levels, because I came from a smaller CRO to a larger CRO, and it was, and I saw that distinction in itself. But I think the bigger CROs have more business. Yeah. So they have business, you need specific individuals to do specific tasks. Otherwise, you overburn and you overwork that one individual if you had those things.
Dude, the PM I worked for on my last project, hats off to him. Because he did the CTM, he was the line manager, he was the project manager. I don't know how he did it, and he was on eight studies. I was just on one.
That's a lot. See, that's a lot of work.
And he's not there anymore.
So there you know, a lot of the CROs actually are looking to adjust the work-life balance, and they care a lot about your work-life balance. The bigger CROs do anyway.
They do?
Yeah, they do care about work-life balance. At least mine does.
So, okay, let's talk about that. So that's good. As someone who's building a CRO, right now we're doing all the work, like myself and Chris and a few other people, we're wearing all the hats, right? But as we get bigger projects, like multi-sites, right now our biggest study has three sites, so it's pretty manageable. But once we get to like the 20s and the 30s, which at some point will come, I'm going to be very interested in retention, employee, and part of retention is work-life balance. That's a huge part. So you're telling me that the big CROs actually care about that stuff?
Yeah. Well, I can't speak because I've heard of other CROs, not the one that I work at. I'm very fortunate at the CRO that I work for that they really do value that stuff. But I've heard from some of my colleagues at competitive CROs, at other competitive CROs, that it's they don't care for the work-life balance and they overburn and they overstress you. Maybe, and actually, it can actually go not even the CRO, it can be very project specific too, within the CRO.
Different people make a big difference.
Exactly, right. Who you report to can make a huge difference in a matter of things.
I've
been very fortunate to have very great people that I report to.
Yeah, I have so much more empathy now. Just my little stint with another CRO I worked for, I started out with a very, like, we got along very well. My line manager, my lead CRA, I reported to her. She figured out that I was a brand new CRA and she kind of helped me out. And then months later, I was transferred to another dude. He was complete opposite. And he was like, just sent back every report, like, you're missing a dash. Instead of him doing it himself, he would just send these things back and say, please correct, and just like little things like that. And at that moment, I understood why CRAs leave and why there's so much turnover. And I was like, I'm ready to leave right now. I mean, and I don't need the job. But so someone who needs it, you know, they're going to be panicking at that point. They're like, how am I going to deal with this? I need to start looking elsewhere.
No, absolutely. It really depends on the person. That's what it boils down to.
You've been lucky. You've been fortunate.
I've been very fortunate. You know, I count my blessings for that. And everyone I work with is understandable. That's not saying that some days, you know, I won't have to put in extra hours and, you know, travel a lot more and kind of go a little above and beyond. I always like to go above and beyond in everything that I do, but sometimes it's, you know, even more than what I could handle, but it's just, you know, putting in the longer hours, you know, that extra week because there's a date slot coming up. You need to visit a couple more sites more than you're supposed to in order to make sure that their data is clean. You know, giving that extra push on occasion is absolutely necessary. But when it becomes routine day to day, that's how someone overburns and, you know, gets really tired.
Are you a W-2 or a 1099?
W-2.
Okay. Yeah. And have you ever considered 1099 or?
Kind of going on a consultant basis.
Like a contractor, yeah. Because they get paid more. I mean, that's no secret. It's less stable.
Exactly. So again, that comes down to the individual. You know, I have family members who do consulting work. Not in the field, but it's, you know, and their checks are much higher, right? But benefits could be different because then you have to supply your own benefits.
Right.
And in this day and age, you know, benefits are important depending on where you are in life. If you have a family, if you have a wife, if you have young children that you constantly need the best benefits for, if your kids are healthy, these are all different things to consider.
Yeah.
If you're younger, you have, you know, you're relatively healthy, you have no consistent chronic issues that you need to attend to with a physician, then, you know, the contracting work is maybe good. You can get the bigger bucks up front. It comes down to stability and, you know, your comfort level. Always a trade-off. And you are absolutely right. They get paid significantly more dollars.
Yeah. I learned that also. As a 1099-er and speaking to colleagues who are not, and it's just like a night and day difference.
Oh, yeah.
But I get it because it's stability and benefits is a huge thing. I mean, you know, we're paying stuff, like...
Although you really won't get contract work. You know, if you're just a new CRA, you won't get contract work. You know, you barely know how to monitor. So you need that training. You need that guidance.
Sure.
But as you become more developed, you know, I would say a CRA who has 5+ years of monitoring experience, can go in and seek that contracting work if they wish. But I know people who have been with CROs for 25 years and have no interest in being a 1099er at all.
Me too.
They prefer, you know, letting the company handle the benefits, letting the company handle the taxes. You know, they give the 401k, the benefits, all that stuff, you know, medical, dental, all that, you know, and the having to balance that on their own. But when you're a 1099er, you have to go out and you have to find those trials, you have to make those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to do the biz dev as well.
Exactly.
So back to the day-to-day life as we wrap up. Do you have to run soon?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Good. I like this conversation. So give people an idea of how often you're on the road in a typical month.
In a typical month. Really, really depends on where this trial is and in what area that it is. If, you know, we're just starting up, if all our sites are just starting up, it's going to be relatively slower because, you know, there's a training period and then they need to find the patients and then recruit the patients and all that. If you're jumping in the middle of the study where, you know, everything's routine and you're just doing your interim monitoring visits, you're going to be way more busy. During study startup, it tends to be a little slower. That kind of matters where you are as well.
And how many studies do you have as a CRA?
I have two studies.
Two studies, and how many sites?
I would probably say around 20, which is average.
Total, right? Or 20 per site?
No, 20 total.
20 total, okay. So about 10 per study, okay.
So that's about average for a CRA. You know, sometimes you'll have anywhere from 15 to 25. 15 is on the lower end, 25 is on the higher end. Mm-hmm. So that's, I would say the average load for a CRA is 15 to 25 sites. Average day, you know, if I'm traveling, I wake up, I go to the airport, I get to the hotel if I'm, you know, going the night before, the site if I'm going the day of.
You have TSA pre-check?
Of course.
Okay, good.
Absolutely.
That's the way to roll.
Absolutely. You know, all these little perks, they come in so handy for you when you are on the road as frequently as I am. You know, if I'm doing 2-3 site visits in a week, you know, I'm you know, I go to the airport here, you know, I see some of the same flight attendants. Rarely, but I see some of the same flight attendants. I see the same TSA pre-check staff, you know, not at the same post every time, but I run into them, and that's because you're there so frequently. You get it down to a T. You know, you live out of a bag.
Yeah.
You really, a carry-on bag. I never check a bag because
you ever wake up and not know what city you're in?
Absolutely. 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 And I'm carrying sometimes a discussion with someone on the plane and they're like, oh, where are you heading? And because I came from somewhere and I'm laying over somewhere, you know, I have to think a little longer. Like, oh, yeah, I'm going here. When you travel that frequently, you wake up, especially if you're going across time zones. Fortunately, I don't have to do that too often. But, you know, like I'm in Philadelphia. I had to go out, you know, to the West Coast, somewhere with high elevation. Killed me. Go a flight up stairs, winded. Absolutely.
Wow.
Because I'm not used to the higher elevation.
Yeah. Do they try to keep you in your region? Like you're in Philly, so.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And from a business standpoint, you know, biz development standpoint, that's very important because you don't want your CRA to charge all that time. You know, traveling. You want to keep your CRA as close as possible to where their sites are, so they don't have to.
But if you're salaried, though, does it matter? If you're like on a salary, do they really care? Like, or I guess with overtime, right?
Well, I mean that you, if you're salaried, again, but they don't want you to burn your time traveling the whole time. You know, because they don't want you, because if you have to travel 15 hours to get wherever you need to go, and then you have to monitor, you're going to overburn. you know, and that's going to be bad for you.
Yeah.
And that's going to be negative on your work and, you know, the type of quality of work that you're going to deliver. So you don't want someone to travel across the entire U.S. You kind of want to keep them regional so there's more time for them to actually do what they need to do.
Yeah.
It's always best to do it that way.
Interesting. Okay. And so overall, you see this as a good career for someone such as yourself? Like, do you have ambitions to be a project manager? Or
yeah, absolutely. I always, ever since I went into college and I made that transition to clinical research, I always looked at the endpoint, and my endpoint is always to jump into management.
Mm-hmm.
So I always jump at opportunities to take any manager tasks, whether it's, you know, training, developing, looking at something with budgets, you know, anything that's basically above my pay grade, or above my role, I take the opportunity to do it because it's a learning experience.
That's right.
And, you know, the second I get to do it, the second I can say I've done this before, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
So I, you know, that's the angle, you know.
That's the same thing. I'm the same way. The someone I was working with, they said, hey, do you want to do I need a GCP auditor for a site. Do you want to do it? I said, say no more. Yes, I'm going to figure out how to do it. I mean, you just got to keep reaching. If you want to grow, if you're happy with what you're doing, great. But if you want to grow,
CRAs that are plan on retiring as CRAs, they've been doing it 20, 30 years. I know the longest CRA that I know that has been doing this is closer to 30 years. You know, I can probably do this for a while, but, you know, in terms of reaching my goals and my aspirations of where I want to go and what I want to get to, I want to go into project management. And because I feel like my mind thinks like that, you know, my mind is, I can delegate, I can talk to different teams, cross-functional units, and bring them in together. That's how my mind works. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, that's where I want to be. Someone may not want to do that, you know, and just, you know, very similar. I just met a recent mom at a conference that I went to, and she's okay with being an in-house CRA the whole time because she doesn't want to go on the road and travel. So the CRA world is not for everyone. You know, there's a lot of traveling. There's a lot of time away from your family. It's quite isolated. When you're traveling all the time, it's just you.
Right.
You get to the site, you do your thing, you leave, you go back to your hotel. So it's not for everyone. But, you know, some people love it. I love what I do.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have a passion for what I do. Like anything else, if you're in it for the paycheck, you're going to hate it. Because like any other job, you know, every job comes with its bad points, whether you're, you know, a lawyer,
yeah,
a physician, or a, you know, a clinical researcher or an auditor. Everything has its good and its bad.
Everything. Your dream job is going to have things you hate.
Exactly.
So like doing these YouTube videos, there's things I hate. I mean, you know.
You know, we're going to go off here and then you're going to have to edit certain things, you know, and
yeah,
that takes hours, you know, whether you want to or not. At the end of the day, if you're doing it for the paycheck, you're going to hate it. But if you really have a passion for this and you really care to improve medicine and improve where we are going in industry and help people and help physicians, you know, take care of their patients, you're going to love this because you get interaction with those staff members. And some of these staff members really genuinely care about these patients,
mm-hmm,
you know. When those patients die or when you see those patients improve in their health, you know, that's very gratifying to me. You know, when I'm sitting there and I'm reading the medical records, you know, they experience this AE, sometimes I feel bad, you know, and it takes a toll on you sometimes, you know, if you're in oncology or these kind of terminal diseases.
Yeah.
it takes a toll, because you feel like you develop connections with some of these patients, although you will never get to meet them.
Right.
But because you're tracking their history, that's something you get the privilege of doing. You know, it becomes really gratifying in being able to go through this journey with them, and seeing them, you know, come out on top at the end, whether their disease is improved or it's not getting worse, or hopefully getting the drug to market and they can keep taking it regularly at the end of the trial. Mm. So it's you know, it's about finding your passion in this field. And in clinical research, you don't have to be a CRA. There's so many different roles in the industry, whether you want to go into QA, you want to go into supplies, you know, you want to go into reg, you want to go into, you know, pharmacovigilance. There's biz development. There's so many different aspects within the field that, you know, find something that you want
to
do.
I tell all the students that come to the CRA Academy, they're attracted to CRA, you know, bright lights, big paychecks. And then once they're done with our 3-month program, they learn that, hey, you know, I can do trial master file. I could be an in-house CRA. I could be a project manager. I could be a consultant. I could open my own clinic. Like, we've had students come in that wanted to be CRAs. When they graduated, they opened their own sites. Now they're doing that. Like, study coordinator. There's just so many opportunities in this industry. I think anyone who gets involved in this industry is lucky in some aspect, because it's an industry that's in demand. There's so many opportunities. The pay is good. We're lucky to get in this industry. And so for those that want to get in the industry, as we wrap up, and we got to do part 2 and part 3 because this is good. We have a lot of ambitious people watching. They want to get in the industry. They don't know how. What do you recommend they do?
What I recommend is, one, start somewhere, you know, anywhere. If you're a student, there's actually, you know, I'm starting to see like clinical research bachelor degrees come out actually now in institutions. Like institutions, academic institutions who are accredited are starting to recognize this, that this is a career path for folks. And so if you're a student, I would say, you know, pursue one of those. If you are not a student and or you don't want to go back to school, start out at your normal clinic, you know, see if even clinicals for you, right? Sometimes people don't want to come near anything pertaining to, you know, needles and hospitals and doctors and those staff. You have to interact with those people, you know, you have to go through clinics and you're touring sometimes and you see things, and if that's not for you, you know, you pass out at the first sight of a needle or the first smell of like formaldehyde or something like that, not for you. There's again different aspects of it for the CRA. And then I would say just intern, you know, that's, I would say, is the best thing for anyone that's trying to break into any field, is go intern, go out, you know, cold call, go out to a person and talk to someone. Stop posting on job boards and kind of just staying behind of a screen. Go somewhere, make connections with someone and say, hey, be frank with them. Be like, hey, I don't know much, but I'm willing to volunteer my time. I'm very hardworking. I'm ambitious, and I really want to learn. And I'm a quick learn. And I don't know about you, but I don't know who wouldn't take anyone doing free work that is bright and willing to just sponge in. Anyone will.
Andy, we can do this all day. You exactly my sentiments on this. I actually take it a step further. If you go, the easiest way to get in at a site, and you can even start getting paid if you do it well, but here's the catch. You actually have to provide some value. So every site needs help recruiting patients. Every site, whether it's mining their own database, going out in the community, doing lunch and learns, go in there, tell them you're a patient recruiter, right? This is what studies do you need help with? I'm here. You don't need to pay me unless someone randomizes, and then we'll work something out. Here's what I want to get out of this. I want to build up my CV. If you like my work, I would like to assist somehow in the clinic for free.
I don't know who's going to say no.
I would say yes to someone who did that right now. Like, you know, literally come to my clinic now, say you're going to recruit patients. You're in.
Absolutely, because people's time is very valuable, so you do have to offer value, right? They aren't going to take someone who, one, they think is going to hinder them, or to potentially mess up, you know, their opportunities, their rapport with clients, their data sets, etc. Go in, be smart, look the part, and be willing to do what no one else wants to do.
Exactly.
And, you'll get something somewhere.
And I've never said this before, but the patient recruitment thing, it does work. There has been people that have done that and have gone on to get hired. Another thing you can do, because it is 2017 going on 2018 now, go to the clinic. Hopefully you're a little tech savvy. If not, you got to figure something else out. But if you're tech savvy, go in there, look at their website, say, hey, I'm going to redo your website for free. I'm going to manage your social media networks. Oh, you don't have a Facebook page? I'll create one. Oh, you don't have a YouTube channel? What do you mean? Okay, I'll create it. Don't worry. For free. I just want some experience on my resume and be involved in your stuff.
That's add it. Value. Add value. That's all I would say is add value. And that's the best. It works. Hard work really works. You know, yeah. It pays.
If you have time, if the person has time, I know some people need to have an income, and in that case, you gotta work Uber or do something to make income and do this on the side.
Yeah, because, you know, the thing about these clinics is they usually run, you know, during normal business hours. A few times you won't find, rarely, you will find someone that's running something in the evening or overnight, or, you know, unless you're in an emergency department or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's hard work pays off. And if there's someone that's trying to do a career change, exactly that, you know, if you're doing a career change, there's something you're good at because you've done it previously. So whatever skill that is, I don't know what you've done. You know, you could be a lawyer and want to jump into this. If you're a lawyer,
transferable skills.
You're very good at drafting things, right? You're very good at drafting things. You're able to sift through many documents and motions and legal paperwork that I could never do because I just find it so boring.
Yeah.
But that transfers. You know, I can sit there and read you a 100-page protocol. We have 100-page protocols. You have a 100-page legal contract, I have a 100-page protocol. You know, if you are a person in film and you want to go into clinical research, you have the personality, you know, you have the persona, you have the people skills, you gotta be able to communicate with people. That can transfer over. You know, if you're a mathematician, you're a problem solver, you know, things can carry over. So whatever you're doing, try to apply it to something in the field. And if it doesn't work, try again and try again.
Keep trying. Grit. It's a great book. Everyone should go read it. Thank you, Mina. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
We'll do this again for sure. And we're going to follow your career trajectory with regular updates. Okay.
Of course.
And Yeah, and we'll be in touch for sure. And thank you, everyone, for listening, watching. You can connect with Mina on LinkedIn. I'll have the links. Mina Youssef.
Yes.
Youssef.
That's right.
Thank you, Mina, and thank you, everyone else. And we'll catch up later. Bye-bye.
So, hey, everybody, thank you very much for listening to another episode of Random Musings from the Clinical Trials Guru. Again, if you haven't already, make sure you subscribe to this podcast. Make sure you leave a review, if you could be so kind, please. And also go to theclinicaltrialsguru.com if you're interested in learning more about who I am, who some of my guests are. You can have access to some of my YouTube videos. I do a lot of videos about clinical research. So go to theclinicaltrialsguru.com. And you can also call or text me anytime, 949-415-6256. Also follow me on any social media platform. It's Dan Svera. And you can also email me if you'd like, dan@theclinicaltrialsguru.com. Thank you very much.